And now, Pastor Compere.
This is Bertrand L. Compere, and I want to talk to you about the rod of God's anger. When the fate of all civilization hangs in the balance, everyone wishes he knew what the future holds. You can't find the answer in any modern publication. Even today's newspaper can give you only yesterday's news. For tomorrow's news and next year's, you must read the Bible, and most of this is in the Old Testament. God spoke many prophecies through the prophets who wrote between 1800 and 3500 years ago. Some of these concerned their own times and were fulfilled then. Yet the greatest of these, and probably the most numerous, concern our own days. As the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, they are written for our admonition, upon whom the end of the age is come. Many other prophets remind us of this, especially Daniel. Repeatedly, God emphasized that his word to Daniel was for the last days, such as, "Understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days. Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." Besides the internal evidence of the dating of other prophecies, God twice told Jeremiah, "In the latter days ye shall consider it." So the prophets are speaking to us today. They warn us of the great events now shaking the world. They told us how we could have avoided the terrible dangers of these days. And, since God knows our mulish stubbornness and dense stupidity, they also warn us of the consequences of our national disobedience. The Bible clearly shows that the rise and fall of empires are no mere accidents. They play their part in God's plans. When cruel and wicked nations threaten us with slavery or destruction, it is for a judgment on our disloyalty to our God and His laws. If we had obeyed Him, we would never have allowed wickedness to rise to power. In this end of the age, God's judgments are to begin through the activities of other races and nations. Therefore, no warning could be of any use if it were merely in the abstract. It must tell us not only what, but also who. You who are trying to keep and perfect a civilization designed according to your national and racial ideals, you are the descendants of 100 generations like yourselves who began the work you try to complete. The civilization you have could not have been built by your efforts alone. You would not have known what to build without the work of your ancestors, who taught you the ideals which you now try to make into concrete realities. You and your world are the product of your race. A large part of the world is inhabited by people who hold the bitterest hatred for you, your civilization, and your ideals, for everything you recognize as good. It is not geography that does this. There's nothing about Asia or Africa as mere land areas which is hostile to you. It is only the people therein who hate you. Only a few short years ago, they were more or less friendly. So what changed them into enemies? Not our own actions, for we have done nothing harmful to them. In fact, we have burdened ourselves down with ruinous taxation and a public debt greater than that of all the rest of the world, mostly to help them. Yet they have changed from lukewarm friends to enthusiastically bitter enemies. Since our own actions didn't cause this change, then who did it? For the answer, we must go back far into ancient history, for all that exists today has its roots deep in the past. The saying, "You can't follow the game without a program," is doubly true here, because most people don't know who's playing on which team. Everyone alive today had ancestors who lived in Jesus Christ's time, others who lived in the days of Moses, and others long before that. These ancestors founded cohesive races and nations, and they created customs, organizations, and institutions which exist today. That is why the Bible continues to prophesy future activities of Assyria and Babylon centuries after those ancient empires had been destroyed. Their cities were burned, but the people who built them lived, and their customs and institutions still functioned, although transferred to other places. Today, they still affect our daily lives, and we are ruled by the descendants of the people who created them. You are actually governed by the Babylonian system, economic, political, and religious, as effectively as if you were living in the days of King Nebuchadnezzar. You are in the same peril of Assyrian military conquest as you would have been in the days of King Sennacherib. An empire is built upon the masses who furnish its armies and its labor force, but it is not created by them. They are only the tools in the hands of the ruling leaders. Many empires have been ruled by alien kings, so we must look to history to show us the directing forces, the ruling people, who have shaped and who still shape the course of history. We find the beginning of today's death struggle of races and religions in Genesis 3, verse 15, where God says to Satan, "I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed." The same Hebrew word for seed or descendants was used in both instances, showing that Satan was to have just as literal flesh and blood seed or born descendants as was Eve. Here is given the lineup of the two opposing sides. The rest of the Bible is the history of this conflict and the prophecies of its end in the earth-shaking climax of the age in our days. The Bible and history show us that Satan's children became the rulers of empires century after century, and they always sought our destruction. The first such empire they ruled seems to have been the Assyrian. In the days when Adam and Eve were still in the Garden of Eden, the Assyrians were already a mighty empire. Ezekiel 31, verses 3 to 9 tells it, "Behold, the Assyrian was a cedar in Lebanon, with fair branches and with forest shade. Its stature was exalted above all the trees of the field, and under its shadow dwelt all great nations. The cedars in the garden of God could not hide him, nor any tree in the garden of God was likened to him in his beauty, so that all the trees of Eden that were in the garden of God envied him." Now obviously, no mere wooden tree could envy anybody. These were the racial and national family trees of the various peoples who were then existing. Like Babylon, Assyria went through alternate periods of greatness and of decline. There is much evidence that Cain was a ruler of this first great empire, extending from the Persian Gulf across all Western Asia and into the islands of the Mediterranean Sea, a magnificent, highly civilized, but also cruel and evil empire. By 3500 BC, it had collapsed. But its civilization made possible the subsequent rise of Babylon among the Chaldeans to the south. Isaiah 23, verse 13 says, "Behold the land of the Chaldeans. This people was not till the Assyrian founded it for them that dwell in the wilderness. They set up the towers thereof. They raised the palaces thereof." Now don't yawn and say, "Well, what has all this long dead stuff got to do with me?" The descendants of the men who ruled this ancient empire are your masters today. They control the economic system under which you earn your living. They set your wages and the prices you pay for food and clothing. And they are the real but hidden rulers of the nations who are guiding them into the approaching war which you dread. Hadn't we better find out how they are handling your destiny? After a gap of about 2,200 years, Assyria again became supreme for 7 centuries of continued war, plunder, and cruelty. The distinguishing characteristics of this empire were, first, an insatiable lust for conquest and plunder, second, horrible cruelty to their victims, and third, holding their victims in permanent slavery, often deporting them to other lands. While kindness was not characteristic of those days, still no other ancient people stained its record as horribly as did Assyria, whose cruelty was clearly a racial characteristic. Here's a mild sample from King Ashurnasirpal's official records of one of his wars. "With battle and slaughter I attacked the city and captured it. Many captives I burned with fire. I captured many of their soldiers alive. I cut off the hands and feet of some. I cut off the ears and noses of others. I put out the eyes of many soldiers. Their young men and maidens I burned with fire. The city I overthrew, dug it up and burned it with fire. I annihilated it." Do you say this is just primitive savagery? But is it any different from what Khrushchev now threatens to do to any free people who resist communism? The Assyrian characteristics are still here. Now, let's see if the Assyrian people are still here. The ancient Assyrian Empire fell about 612 BC when its capital city, Nineveh, was destroyed exactly as the prophet Nahum had prophesied. But we know that the survivors of its ruling class fled into what is today southwest Russia, into the same area from which came Stalin and Khrushchev. They dared not remain in their old homeland, where they would be subject to the vengeance of the nations they had ruled with such horrible cruelty, so they became refugees, displaced persons. Who were these people, these cruel and bloody tyrants? In the northern part of the drainage basins of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, they were known as Assyrians. Those of them who lived west of Assyria were known as Hittites and Canaanites. Their own statues and monuments prove them to be racially identical. In the ruins of ancient Hittite cities, we have found sculptured palace walls and statues in which they portray their own people. On the walls of palaces in the ruins of Nineveh and Nimrud, we have found magnificent mural decorations in painted and glazed tile and beautifully carved alabaster friezes, which show the Assyrians as portrayed by their own artists. Among both nations, these carvings and paintings show them to be characterized by prominent hooked noses, usually somewhat thick lips, and mostly with curly hair. This same race walks the streets of our cities today, bearing the same characteristics, but we call them Jews. Their typical conduct is today the same as it was in ancient Assyria. First, the lust for plunder and conquest. By violent revolution, as the Bolsheviks, they conquered Russia in 1917 and 1918. And between 1917 and 1939, they murdered at least 32 million Russians. First, they murdered many millions of peaceful Russians because these would not give up their Christian religion. They also murdered other millions of Russian peasants because they wanted to be free men, owning their own little farms, instead of becoming slaves on the government's collective farms. And everywhere, city or country, they murdered everyone whom they suspected of wanting his freedom. Thus, they gained a modern Assyria, organized for conquest, just like the ancient one. When they conquered and enslaved their neighbors by military violence, they showed the same old traits. They took over the little Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, then half of heroic Finland, then Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Albania, and Hungary. Wherever their bestial armies came, they plundered the land bare as if a plague of locusts had passed, stealing everything from fountain pens to factory machinery. They raped the women and treated the conquered populations with horrible barbarity. Truly, it was a typical Assyrian conquest. Next, their characteristic cruelty. They promptly organized the captured nations into a typical communist society where everyone must spy upon everyone else, and the only recognized virtues are treachery and betrayal. Even the little children are compelled to report what their parents talk about. Anyone who is suspected of opposing the ruling race or who has been denounced by some anonymous informer is dragged off to prison and tortured to force him to confess and involve others in his so-called treason. For any wistful hope of freedom is called treason in their empire. It is notorious that they have used all the resources of modern science to develop new methods of torture more horrible than those known in the past. So again we see the characteristics of this hook-nosed Assyrian Jew race in action. Finally, their ancient evil trait, revived now that they have regained power, of holding their captives in permanent slavery, often deporting them to slave camps in other lands. If you know anything of what was going on in the world these last 20 years, surely I need not go over the melancholy list of their works in detail. Every conquered nation is just one huge slave camp. Thousands of Germans, Hungarians, Czechs, and Poles have been deported to slow death in Siberia. Most of the adult male population of Lithuania has been deported to Siberia, and Mongol men have been brought in to breed the Lithuanian women to make a more docile slave race. If you doubt that the masters of communism are Jewish, let me remind you of this. Karl Marx was the grandson of a rabbi on both sides of his family, and his chief collaborator Engels was also a Jew. On down through to this day, the most important communist leaders have been Jewish, or in a few instances, have had Jewish wives. When Khrushchev was in this country on his recent trip, and he was asked about anti-Semitism in Russia, he gave one of the few true statements he has ever made when he told the reporter, "Every member of the Communist Politburo is either Jewish or has a Jewish wife." Again, consider this. In every communist country, to be anti-Christian is not only a virtue, it is a compulsory virtue. But to be anti-Jewish is punishable by death. Truly, the race which with force and treachery rules Russia and her satellite slave states is unchanged from ancient times. It is still our deadly enemy, which has sought our destruction since its first appearance in history. They are the children of Satan, as Jesus Christ himself says in John 8, verse 44. And the enmity between them and us is that prophesied by God himself in Genesis 3, verse 15. Therefore, even the slightest trace of common sense would have told us not to strengthen them. But we have allowed these Assyrian Jews among us to corrupt our leaders until they used our national strength and wealth to build up our enemies, contrary to God's strong warning. We found communist Russia tottering to her fall from internal weakness, and we let Roosevelt betray the world into her hands after strengthening her into the monster which she is today. And to compound our sin in keeping these Assyrian Jews in command of Russia, we have also created the United Nations, and we seek to make it the master of all the world, an organization in which the pagan and wicked nations hopelessly outnumber and outvote the entire civilized world. Just the cannibal savage nations of Africa alone outvote the United States by 24-1. But this was prophesied. Since the tribe of Ephraim was the kingly tribe in the northern kingdom of Israel, God often speaks of Israel as Ephraim. In Hosea 17, God says, Ephraim mixes himself among the nations. Strangers have devoured his strength, and he does not know it. Instead of relying upon our God, we seek the approval and assistance of pagan nations. So Hosea says, Ephraim has become like a silly, witless dove. They call to Egypt. They run off to Assyria. And indeed we do. We wonder why the pagan, dark-skinned nations are turning against us. But we were not satisfied to leave in power over any of them, any government which was friendly to us. We corruptly betrayed Chiang Kai-shek in order to drive him out of China and put the Reds in control. We forced Holland to leave Indonesia so Sukarno could make it pro-Red and a submarine refueling base for Russia. We used unbearable economic pressure on France, Belgium, and Britain to force them out of Africa, and now the savage Negro nations blackmail us with the threat of voting on Russia's side unless we give them countless billions of dollars. We conspired to throw Batista out of Cuba, not because he was a dictator, for our State Department just loves red dictators like Tito in Yugoslavia and Gomulka in Poland. And we treacherously helped Castro to power when our State Department knew positively that he was a communist. And now he sets up for Russia rocket bases, bomber airfields, and submarine bases just 90 miles off our shores. These red governments are really of our own making. So, God speaks about us through Hosea. They have set up kings, but not for me. They have made rulers, but I have not acknowledged them. They have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. The nations for whom we bankrupted ourselves now despise us. Those we paid bribes to won't stay bought. So again, God speaks about us through Hosea. Soon shall they be among the nations like a worthless thing, for they have gone up to Assyria like a wild ass wandering by itself. Ephraim loves gifts, but though they hire among the heathen, I will soon gather them up, and they shall sigh, depressed by the load of the ruler of kings. Do we learn from this? No, we still try to make deals with the devil. We whine to Khrushchev that we want to make agreements with him, when the only real trouble is that he won't keep the agreements already made. And again, God prophesied this through Hosea. When Ephraim saw his sickness, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Pickquarrel, yet he couldn't heal nor cure you of your wound. What lesson must we yet learn from this? The inevitable result of our own wrongdoing. As Hosea tells it, ye have plowed wickedness, ye have reaped iniquity, ye have eaten the fruit of lies. We allowed our own corrupt politicians to build up this evil power until it now imperils the whole world. We kept them in office when they did this in an evil bargain to win the support of a Jewish minority group, which we all knew to be wicked. Since we did this in hypocritical self-righteousness, saying that we supported the most horrible dictatorship of all time against Hitler and Mussolini because they were dictators, we must now face the work of our own hands. So, God explains it in the 10th chapter of Isaiah. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send him against an hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey, and to tread them down like mire in the streets. The hypocritical nation well describes our own international policy, and today we are eating the bitter fruit of it. The people of my wrath can be clearly identified as another nation, as we shall soon see. Atomic war with Russia is the inevitable result of our own corrupt politics, which built up Red Russia and Red China to world powers. To punish us, Russia, under control of the Assyrian Jews, is the rod of God's anger. In the 14th chapter of Isaiah, we find a pretty good description of Khrushchev if he carries out his threats. Is this the man that made the earth to tremble, that did shake kingdoms, that made the world as a desert and destroyed the cities thereof, that opened not the house of his prisoners? He now threatens to make the world a desert and destroy the cities thereof, and surely he has opened not the house of his prisoners. Now verses 24 to 26 in this chapter clearly connect this up with Assyria. Their military attack upon us is prophesied, including actual invasion of our land. Micah 5, verses 5 and 6 speaks of the time when the Assyrian shall come into our land, and when he shall tread in our palaces. Now this does not refer to the invasion of Palestine by ancient Syria, for that was already past when Micah wrote this prophecy of the future. And it has not happened since then, therefore it is still ahead of us. Also, Isaiah 14, verses 24 to 26, covers this same invasion and shows that it is part of a tremendous worldwide conflict. It reads, "The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely as I have thought, so shall it come to pass, and as I have purposed, so shall it stand, that I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders. This is the purpose that is purposed upon the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out upon all nations." Now this is far greater than any ancient war. It must be the great invasion by Russia and her satellite slave states, prophesied in the 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel. And note that God speaks of breaking the Assyrian in his own land and upon his own mountains. Now this has never happened in the past. The Assyrians were not broken in the land of Israel, but only destroyed in their own country. Also note one other hopeful thing, that when this Jewish-led monster is destroyed, it says, "Then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders." The terrible economic yoke of the Jews under which we labor at present will be lifted from us. The long and detailed prophecies of the 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel show that Russia's red hordes will make a double invasion, one through the Near East, driving down east and then south to Turkey, through Iran and Iraq and Jordan, then through the Jewish state and Palestine to seize Egypt and the Suez Canal. The other invasion will be principally by air, across the North Pole and also out of eastern Siberia, down through Canada into the United States. In the Palestinian invasion, the United Nations will be involved. For only this can fulfill the prophecy of Zechariah 12, verse 3, and 14, verse 2. "In that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered against it. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle." This could only happen if all nations are represented there by the United Nations. This Palestinian invasion will be defeated by the return of our Lord Jesus Christ, as Zechariah 14, verses 3 and 4 says, "Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof, toward the east and toward the west. And there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south." It'll be a worldwide judgment, for neutrality is not possible between good and evil, and all nations will be forced to choose one side or the other, as the Assyrian Jewish communists rise to conquer and enslave the world. Everyone must either oppose them or become part of their satanic system. So, Zephaniah 3, verse 8 tells us, Therefore, wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger. For all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my zeal. Another confirmation of the double invasion prophesied in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is found in Isaiah 10, verse 6, where God says of the Assyrian, I will send him against an hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge, to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Our own hypocrisy in strengthening evil nations under the pretense of doing good identifies us as the hypocritical nation. The people of God's wrath are identified in Malachi 1, verses 3 and 4. For there God calls the Edomites, the people against whom the Lord hath indignation forever. The article on Edom in the Jewish Encyclopedia concludes with these words, The Edomites today are found in modern Jewry. We know that they now occupy much of Palestine, right in the path of Russia's invasion from the east, where fighting will cause terrible devastation. They think that they are so completely the masters of the Russians that they can with impunity bring Russia's armies through Palestine to attack the Western world. But the enslaved Russians know who their oppressors are, and when the fighting breaks out in that land, the Russians will decide that since they must do the fighting and the dying for Jewish communism, they might as well also seize for themselves the spoil. But what of the other Russian-Assyrian invasion out of the north into the United States? Ezekiel 38 and 39 go into great detail, telling how it will be made partly by air, and that many communist troops will enter our land. But God will fight for us with his terrible powers. Great storms will wreck the Russian air fleets and beat down his armies with huge hailstones. Bog them down hopelessly in bottomless mud and flooding streams which block both advance and retreat while they starve for lack of supplies. Soldiers drafted from unwilling slave states will mutiny, so the Red Army will be destroying itself. Earthquakes and volcanic eruptions will add to the carnage, and through this scene of horror rages pestilence which strikes down those who escape bullet wounds. We can be saved, but only through the fire. We must harvest the bitter fruit of our wicked folly in electing politicians whom we know to be disloyal just because they run on our own party's ticket. We allow them to bankrupt us in order to strengthen our openly admitted enemies, meanwhile neglecting our own defenses. We allow them to make treaties and agreements to put us under the power of nations which envy and hate us, which want to enslave us so they can steal our wealth instead of having to work for their own. The penalty of putting blind loyalty to the mere name of a political party above loyalty to God and country is no longer merely that the spoils of office go to the rascals of one party instead of the rascals of the other. The penalty now is war, which will devastate our great cities. God alone can provide the answer. In Hosea 13, verses 9 and 10, he says, O Israel, thou hast destroyed thyself, but in me is thine help. I will be thy king. Where is any other that may save thee in all thy cities? Again in the 41st chapter of Isaiah, he says, Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed. For I am thy God, I will strengthen thee, yea, I will help thee, and they that strive against thee shall perish. God's punishment of us will come, but it has always been for our correction, not our destruction. The prophet Isaiah pictures this Assyrian-Jewish-Russian attack in terms which leave no doubt that it is the same Red Russian Jewish attack prophesied in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. In chapters 10, 14, 30, and 31, Isaiah says, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send him against an hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit, he means not so, neither does his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations not a few. For he says, By the strength of my hand have I done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent. I have removed the boundaries of the people, and have robbed their treasures, and have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth with it? Therefore shall the Lord of hosts, send among his fat ones leanness. And do you notice, by the way, how failure of crops and leanness is coming in all the communist countries? But Isaiah goes on, And under his glory he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire, and it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God of hosts, O my people that dwell in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian. He shall smite thee with a rod, and shall lift up his staff against thee after the manner of Egypt. For yet a very little while, and the indignations shall cease, and mine anger in their destruction. See, the Lord comes from afar in blazing anger amid rising banks of cloud, his lips filled with fury, and his breath like a devouring fire, breathing fury like a sweeping torrent that reaches to the neck, to sift the nations in the sieve of destruction, and to place in the jaws of the pagans a bridle that leads them to ruin. But for you there will be a song as in the night when a sacred festival is held, and gladness of heart as when one sets out with music to go to the mount of the Lord, to the rock of Israel. For the Lord will cause his glorious voice to be heard, and the descent of his arm to be seen, in furious anger and flame of devouring fire, amid cloudburst and rainstorm and hail. Assyria will be stricken with terror at the voice of the Lord, when he smites with the rod. The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, that I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders. This is the purpose which is purposed upon the whole earth. Then falls Assyria by no hero's sword, destroyed, but by no mortal blade. Assyrians fly before the sword, their very god flies in a panic, their princes scatter in sheer terror, their soldiers are made serfs. And Isaiah 17, verses 13 and 14 adds, They shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a tumbleweed before the whirlwind. It is interesting to note that the tumbleweed, with which we are all so familiar here in the West, is the Russian thistle. But this is not the end. So that they cannot continue to rule in their modern Assyria and regain their strength, we carry the war to them there. Micah 5, verses 5 and 6 promises us, When the Assyrian shall come into our land, and when he shall tread in our palaces, then shall we raise against him seven shepherds and eight princes of men, and they shall waste the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod within her gates. Remember, their leaders, this Assyrian Jewish race, is the race of Satan, identified as such in Genesis 3, verse 15, and in John 8, verse 44. Their actions have been consistently evil since the dawn of history. In Isaiah 14, verses 16 to 21, God prophesies the end of them, leader and people alike, saying, "Is this the man who caused the earth to tremble, who made kingdoms quake, who turned the world into a desert and overthrew its cities, who would not set his prisoners free to return to their homes? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. But you are cast forth away from your tomb like a hateful abortion, clothed like the slain, pierced by the sword, who go down to the stones in the pit as a carcass trodden underfoot. You will not join your fathers in burial, because you have ruined your country. You have slaughtered your people." And now note how this passage in Isaiah concludes. "May the race of evildoers not be mentioned forever. Prepare for his sons a place of slaughter because of their father's guilt, lest they rise and take possession of the earth and fill the face of the world with their cities." Like nearly everything in the Bible, this began in the book of Genesis. It began with Satan's rebellion and his treacherous betrayal of Adam and Eve, which led to thousands of years of misery for all the world. But Satan's triumph was not to be permanent. In Genesis 3:15, God told him, "I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed." In John 8, verses 31 to 44, Jesus Christ himself identifies these children of Satan as the Jews. Scores of generations of our ancestors have spent all their lives defending themselves against the attacks, the infiltration, and the corruption of this people. Today, this final conflict is reaching its climax. The war, which they planned for the enslavement of the world, will instead end with their destruction. As you watch the last act of this great drama of the ages, be glad and proud that it is our God who rules the universe and who will save us as he has promised. Today my subject is scattering the power of the holy people. Most of the prophecies in the book of Daniel were written in obscure language so that the full meaning of the event would not become clear until the time for fulfillment was at hand. One of these, which has puzzled all scholars until very recently, is in the 12th chapter of Daniel. It expressly deals with the time of the very end, so its application to our day shows where we are in history. It reads thus, "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end."